The regular May meeting of the Cambria Community Services District Board of Directors will come to order. Please stand and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance to our flag and country.
Ready to begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We'll now proceed to public comment. This is the time for persons to address the board on items that are not on the published agenda. I have a request to speak from Amanda Rice. In fact, I have two. One of them does not indicate which agenda item. Public comment. Now would be the time then. Amanda?
Thank you, President Sanders. Sorry, I thought I marked both of those.
That's okay.
The topic.
No problem.
Amanda Rice, Cambria. I would like to compliment the general manager, staff, and in particular Kathy Choate for having the full agenda packet for today's meeting available online for the community to review far in advance of the meeting. That's all I have to say today. I really appreciate you doing that, and I am glad to have this public comment at the beginning of, and to have the public comment still also at the end of the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your comment. Next, we'll have Elizabeth Bentenhausen.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. I had submitted, so far as I can tell, this is not on the agenda anywhere. And if it is, just let me know and I'll request to speak later. Excuse me, I just ran out of breath trying to get back here.
That's okay. Take your time.
I submitted a public reports on the whole program. I requested to see these, and I received a response then from the general manager, which says, no documents responsive to your request exist. I raise this as an issue of fiscal responsibility, because if we have an agreement with a federal agency, and they are obliged by the contract or the agreement that was signed to provide quarterly financial reports on all aspects of this agreement and its execution, and there are no such documents, I would very much appreciate if you would start asking the Army Corps of Engineers to send you the documents that the agreement says they will send you quarterly since 2006. Thank you very much.
Thank you. My recollection is that those reports were required on account of the possibility that the district would be spending district money and augmenting core money. Well, I'm just giving you the genesis of it. But the agreement says what it says, and if the Corps is obligated to give us quarterly financial reports, we will ask for them. Thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to address the board under public comments? Seeing none, we'll close the public comments and move to agenda review, additions, deletions, and I would ask whether there are any additions, deletions, or amendments to the agenda. Any consent calendar items that anybody would like to have pulled? Seeing
it's Ben Holm, Commander of the Sheriff's Coastal Patrol Division. We handle Sheriff's Patrol from Havilah Beach up to the Monterey County line. This last month, we handled 218 calls for service and took 30 reports compared to last year with 250 calls for service and 66 reports. So actually took about 30 less reports. And I actually look at that and find that we didn't have any of the theft problems like we did last year. We had only one or two vandalism reports. We had a slew of them about this time last year. And also some of our self-initiated activity is down, and that's probably because of staffing issues right now. While There have been no layoffs itself for at least the Sheriff's Department. We are down over 15 positions, the ones that we didn't fill, and that includes seven deputies, a senior deputy, and a sergeant's position. So staffing is down. As far as crimes go, we did have a couple of them of interest is had a road sign taken from the Cambria Historical Museum. Outside of that, so if you happen to see one hanging in someone's garage, someone's bedroom, says Cambria, population 1,200, it's about 1 foot by 3 foot, maybe they can return it or let us know and we can come get it, collect it from them. Those things usually don't migrate too far from their location there. Also, one thing I want as a public crime prevention thing, we're seeing a lot more fraud. It seems to be where people are in this community are becoming victimized, and don't tell my parents. That's also what happens. And actually, I can relate a little bit. I can see my grandson or telling my grandma, don't tell my dad, you know, type of thing, and she would say, of course not, you know. So they proceed to send money off. This is just another scam, and they send it by Western Union, and so they'll send $2,000, $2,500 off to whatever, you know, location they're told to send the money off because they care. So my advice is that whenever you're sending money through Western Union, specifically, if you're sending it to someone you don't know, you know, think about it for a minute. Take a few minutes on this thing or talk to someone, because that's where just those two things right there, Western Union sent to someone that you don't personally know, and so often becomes a fraud, and there's, you know, large amounts of cash that's been sent. We've seen on some of these things having to do lotteries and stuff where someone sent in $20,000 of their life savings. Okay. So if you hear about anything like that, you hear someone saying they're going to have to go down and take some money out to send it by Western Union to somebody, real hard cash, try to prevent that from happening. We're preparing for the July 4th festivities along the coastal area. Particularly, we're focusing on Cayucas again. I think the Sheriff's Department's done a great job in Cayucas the last couple years. I talked to a lot of the citizens in Cayucas a couple years ago and said, hey, if I had a place a couple blocks up from the beach before, we have zero tolerance for any alcohol in or around the pier area down there or any fireworks at all that are privately, you know, private shows at all, whether they're Safe as Sane or the, you know, bottle rockets type of thing. So any fireworks in that area at all, any alcohol in that area at all, if it's outside, is going to be we're going to do some enforcement action on it one more time this year. So, any questions?
Thank you, Commander. Any questions? Thank you again. Appreciate you being here. We will now move to managers and boards report, and we'll begin with the general manager's report.
Okay, thank you. Just a few things to report, and then I've got some staff members here for a couple of presentations. The online calculator for the water and sewer rates is now up on our website at www.cambriacsd.org. It's really simple to operate. It's merely just put in what your consumption is, and it calculates not only what your rates are today, but what they will be under the proposed rates. I made a note that the PROS Commission has met, and their next meeting is on Tuesday, June 2nd at 10 a.m. That's next week in our Suite 204. The rainfall here is below average for this time of year, but Brian believes in his report that will keep us in good shape until late summer. We are currently operating SR4. It's online for 8 hours a day now. I'm going to come back to Brian in just a second. He is busy, he and his staff, working on getting SCADA equipment installed. I think this has pretty much been an everyday task here these past few weeks. And again, I'll mention why he's busy doing that today. You'll notice today that we have our fire that we had here in Cambria as well. That's why they're in the audience. But just moving along before they come up, they did send out the notices for the fire hazard fuel reduction program. Those went out on April 10th. And the deadline for clearing is June 15th. And Mark notes in his report that if there's any questions, to feel free to contact the fire department at 927-6240. Finally, in the finance manager's report, there was one disbursement last month in April, and that was for the bond payment to Union Bank in the amount of $249,295. Al reports that the balance in the local agency investment fund as of April 30th was $4.3 million. That includes interest of $20,000. And we do now have the independent auditor's report and financial statements for fiscal year 2007-2008 also posted on the CCSD website. Just a couple of things that came on after these reports were published, and one is that I wanted to bring to the board's attention just a small budget alert with regard to litigation expenses. I've noticed these past couple of months, and this is no reflection on the current district council contract, so I don't want to put them in the hot seat over here, that we've spent roughly $10,000 last month in litigation expenses and $10,000 the month before. And that's for four cases that we're currently working under based on upon your direction, the board's direction. That is the Land Watch case that's represented by Cynthia Hawley. That's the Greg Burge case, the Joe Lindsay case, and then the Warren Dump case that we're actually coordinating legal efforts with regard to an appointed counsel through SDRMA. But I just want to give you that heads up. We have that we're working on some standard operating procedures with regard to getting water turned off a little bit quicker and working out those procedures between fire and water. We'll be meeting, Jim Adams and Mark Miller will be meeting on those things in the coming weeks so that we can get a policy to help resolve that issue in the future. We've only had one claim filed to date for $145. And the mosquito vector and disease control assessment ballots that were mailed to the CCSD, since I have the authority to enter into contracts, I did, and I voted no. And they're being returned with a no vote. We don't have that money budgeted. And even though it's zero on some of our parcels and nominal on others, it's not budgeted for fiscal year 9-10. So those are going to be returned as a no vote. And then on the last item, well, I'm going to wait just a second for the fire department because I want to announce that Brian Bodie has turned in his retirement notice. And this is the last meeting that we will see him at. His retirement will be effective in mid-August, but he has accumulated leave time, and he will actually be with us for only a couple more weeks, June 16th. So I'm putting him on the hot bird seat, made him sit over here with me this time. He's been with the district for 31 and a half years, as I recall, but he has 37 and a half years worth of public service. When he walks out the door, that's the institutional knowledge that this community loses. He has other opportunities besides his lovely grandchildren and lovely wife and family that he will be pursuing, and he's given his time as far as I'm concerned, and he is too. So I want to congratulate him on those monumental tasks of spending that much time in the Veg fire and then the Jesusita fire as well. So thank you.
I'll speak about the Veg fire here in town and then turn it over to Captain Gallagher for a briefing on the Jesusita fire. Good afternoon, Mr. President, members of the board. Thanks for allowing us the time to speak to you. We're in the third year of drought conditions, and I think it's starting to kind of show up in some of the fire activity that we've had around the state recently, in that every year for the last three or four years, the fire season seems to be creeping up and starting a little earlier. Most alarming was the big fire, the Jesusita fire out of Santa Barbara, but we also had some of our own activity here that, although the fire conditions weren't as explosive as those down a little further south, indicating that our moisture level is a little bit better here, I couldn't help but think about what would have happened with the scenario that we experienced here if it would have been a month or two later down the road. So I wanted to take a little bit of time. I've got some photos, and I'll kind of brief you, let you ask questions about what happened there. And then I want to make a point on some of the fire safety stuff we're doing, you know, in conjunction with the kickoff of our fire hazard fuel reduction program. And then I would like to turn it over to Captain Gallagher, who we are very proud of at this point in time. The strike team that he was attached to has received a lot of accolades for the job that they did on that fire, and they are accredited with saving several homes down in the area. So nothing but rave reviews on their performance. First of all, I'd like to just advise residents to be wary of the situation that we're in here with the drought conditions and the way things are drying up. Everyone needs to take the time to attempt to get defensible space around their homes as best they can. They need to look for debris, any kind of pine needles in the gutters, on the roof, any kind of combustible debris around their homes. That type of stuff needs to be picked up and cleaned up before the event. Also, any type of obvious fire hazards that may be, you know, evident inside the home, and that goes without saying. But one other thing that I would like to emphasize to residents in Cambria, I would like to see some thought given to evacuation procedures in case something were to happen here. Have that thought through. Have a plan made. Have the things that they want to have close at hand to be able to grab, to take with them, ready to go. Cambria is not an easy community to evacuate from with our narrow road systems and stuff. So let's all keep that in mind. So with that, I'd like to report on our fire that we had May 14th. This started as a result of a tree. One of the big Monterey pines had come down and was threatening a power line. And we were actively in the process, Captain Steve Bitto and myself, of trying to mitigate the situation and get this tree taken out of the way. It had been there for a few days, and we had a work order done, and we were on the phone with PG&E and the Cambria Pines Lodge at the time, and the power blinks out. And we looked at each other, and no, it can't be. And sure enough, the call came in, and it was the tree that we were trying to deal with had come down on the power line, and the whole scenario played out exactly the way Captain Bitto described it. The power line snapped from the poles and whipped down the canyon and ignited the fuels in the canyon, and the fire was running up the hillside. We've got some nice photos here by Elaine Beckham of Cambria Photography. These are her photos. She's a member of our CERT team here as well. So if anybody has a desire and wants to pursue these or get any photos, they can get her website online. It's CambriaPhotography.com.
Pardon me. She's not that photographer, but she got them from him.
Oh, okay.
She's a separate
item. So these are not available through that website?
They are, but not from her. She's not the author of it.
Oh, okay. Do we know who the photographer was? No?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's Brett White.
Brett White. Okay. Sorry about that. You can see that the fire conditions here, this fire did not crown. This was mostly a ground fire. That's our worst fear, is if this gets up into the canopy and runs. If this fire gets up into the canopy, there's not a lot we can do but start evacuating people and try and pull back from it and just clear people out of the way. You can see that the fire conditions here, this covered probably 2 or 3 acres and was definitely not as dramatic as the Jesusita fire, but I would contend that if this were down the road a month or two later, we would have been in some trouble with it. So that pretty well concludes the photos that we have of this fire. Are there any questions about anything that occurred there?
Was there any wind associated with this fire?
There were some wind. There were wind conditions, but I don't think it factored in to into the fire activity and made it any more difficult to fight. Not a sundowner type situation. The wind was a northwest wind. It did contribute to the ignition of the fire by knocking the the tree down onto the power line.
Had it been windy, do you think it could have been much worse?
Typically, you associate the offshore winds with as the dry winds that drive the fire. This type of thing, if it gets into the canopy, it doesn't matter which direction. Our winds are predominantly a northwest moister wind until the winter months. But if this fire is in the canopy, it's going to that northwest wind that we have on a typical day-to-day basis is going to drive it, and it's going to be pretty hard for us to stop. So, but I, as far as this being on the ground, protected in the canyon, the winds were not a factor. But yeah, we worry about that.
Chief, explain how you would coordinate this with CAL FIRE. How does CAL FIRE fit into a situation like this with our fire department?
CAL FIRE is they're the authority on any type of wildland fire. We go to what we call unified command with CAL FIRE in an event of this nature. They have access to resources that can be ordered up as far as air tankers, dozers, all that type of equipment that we could order as a standalone agency, but we would have to pick up the tab for it. So we work in conjunction with CAL FIRE in a combined response in a unified command.
And in this case,
yes,
you were doing it on your own or with CAL FIRE?
We were in conjunction with CAL FIRE. We work well with them. It was actually a county response. We had units from Atascadero and Cayucas there as well on this.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions on this?
Board members? Apparently not.
Okay, I'd like to bring up Captain Mike Gallagher, who will take you through the Hayseseta Fire and talk a little bit about their stellar performance. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Good to see you, Captain Gallagher.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. I was the engine captain boss on the engine 5791, which was dispatched out as part of a mutual aid assignment down to Hayseseta the second night. So that fire had burned a full 24 hours before they notified us. We were prepared that night. As soon as we saw the fire, we contacted dispatch. We had coverage for the station set up for a week within about an hour of that initial startup and the broadcast that there was a fire in Santa Barbara. So department was ready to go. It took them 24 hours to contact us. And what I just want to go over, I've got a short slideshow presentation. Some of the stuff we saw and the conditions that we met down there, and maybe answer some questions if anybody has any questions about the similarities or differences between the Hayseseta fire and what we may see here. So I'll go through this quickly. This is our hard charging crew of four. They staged us the first morning in front of the mission, which was kind of nice. I mean, Santa Barbara's beautiful anywhere you go. I've definitely fought fire in worse places. So they staged us there, and anybody who's been in the military knows there's a lot of hurry up and wait in any operation like that, and that's what happened here. We were assigned out on the line soon after this, and I'll get into that a little bit. This fire started on a Tuesday afternoon. It didn't do much the first night. They weren't real concerned. I was on duty Tuesday night, watched it, left work Wednesday morning thinking we would have no part in it. It looked a little bit like this, just kind of moving around a little bit up in the hills. They had evacuation notices going and everything. But by the next morning, they didn't seem too concerned. This is, and these pictures are taken. There's some by a professional photographer that were emailed to us, and some of them are from the crew. So in this sequence, it gives you an idea of what happened Wednesday afternoon when the fire really blew up and burned down Mission Canyon. The same thing happened Thursday afternoon. In those 2 days, they lost in Santa Barbara about 80 homes. So it started really as not much. They were definitely concerned. They had units on it immediately. They had tankers and helicopters on it all day. And you can see that top part is actually the ocean with the Channel Islands in the background. You can see the offshore down canyon or sundowner winds all blowing towards the town of Santa Barbara, towards the city. Now, we don't have that too often in October, but as Chief, until October, but as Chief mentioned, the northwest wind is predominant, and if we get a fire into the crowns of some of these Monterey pines, it doesn't matter which direction it comes to. But you can see it's a pretty significant wind-driven fire. So that's how it started. You can see a couple of spots on top of the canyons. And this is actually taken by us on Wednesday as we were doing some mop-up assignment. And it starts to get a little bit bigger. Around 4 o'clock, we started to notice this. And then it did this. And pretty soon, it was off to the races. It was clear to us that we were going to be in for another big night. We were going to lose some homes and hopefully not some people. This was in the span of about 45 minutes. And that's the view from the house that we were doing some mop-up on. So it was clear that, if you can see at the bottom right-hand corner, there's a crew doing mop-up. There's a couple of engines. They had to boogie out of there. I'm sure that that house was lost the way this thing came down. It just blew up. So the sequence you saw was about 45 minutes. I'm not sure. Can you push enter on that, Carlos? Can you put the – this is – if you go back one, forward one. If it doesn't work, it's okay. It's just – this is, I actually have about 20 seconds of video footage to show you what the winds do and how this fire swirls around. If we can't do it, that's okay. You can contact us if you want to see it. But it's pretty interesting the way these down canyon winds swirl around and make a fire boil. And this is what we faced on Wednesday afternoon and Tuesday afternoon, the first crews. You can kind of see in the background, there's structures burning and are threatened. This fire was a brush fire, a chaparral, which is different than what we have in Cambria. However, it became a crown fire, so you had a crown fire in brush. What we'll have here is a crown fire in timber, which is much more severe, to be honest with you. So this is Tuesday afternoon, and it's going to start taking homes. And you can see the vegetation up right up to some of these homes. They're not wood frame or combustible homes, but there's nothing going to stop that. Very interesting was a lot of, or a few homes anyway, the outside was okay. They burned from the inside. And the only reason the crews, we knew that there was fire inside was we hear a smoke alarm going off inside. Embers had gotten through little tiny spots in windows and in basements and through the little screens and had started structure fires, what we would consider structure fires, from the inside. And crews had to put on their SCBAs and fight structure fires at the same time bouncing from house to house doing structure protection. So it was a very interesting night.
Captain Gallagher,
sir.
How dense is the development in this area? Or asking it a different way, aren't the houses fairly well spread apart?
Yeah, and that's something I have to mention to you at the end of this, too, is one of the differences is, that's exactly right, they're very spread apart, but the vegetation the defensible space looked adequate in a lot of cases, but next to this defensible space was a smoldering foundation in, 50 or 60 of these homes we looked at. So what they considered acceptable defensible space and what looked fine this drought years, it just isn't cutting it. So there's adequate space because these are multi-million-dollar homes, and nobody sits next to a multi-million-dollar home with another one. But the vegetation just, it's too thick, it's too dry, and it's too close this year. So extra precautions this year. A lot of air tankers. This is the only fire burn in the state, so all resources were available. There's engines as far as Mount Shasta and all the way down to San Diego and everything in between. They had all sorts of air resources flying day and night. And this is what we saw Wednesday night when we went from our mop-up assignment to a structure protection assignment. We were actually awarded with this assignment because the crews were doing such a good job on their day shift that we were pulled off of what we were doing and kind of awarded with this structure protection assignment, which is what we were really after.
Quite an award.
Absolutely, yeah. And we were thrilled with it. And you guys, just so you know, you can be very proud of your crews here. They were, as Chief mentioned, the accolades we received from the strike team leader and the division bosses, division supervisors, kind of reflected on the job that those guys did. And we're relatively new to this. Cambria didn't get out into the Wildland Arena until last year, and now we're doing it more and more often and gaining tremendous amount of operational experience that we're going to bring back when we have to fight fire here. So this is a great opportunity for us. And when I take us out, I look like we're the new guy, and we should be, you know, they're looking at us, and we have everything to prove, and that's what they did. They did a phenomenal job.
Captain?
Sir?
That previous fire, the intense part, is that a structure, do you think, or is that just
No, that's the wildland with the structure involved in it.
Okay.
And that's part of the problem, is that a structure puts off so much heat that it was literally just bouncing from house to house. And normally what we try and do is get engines up there back into the driveway and get hoses around it. But we were losing homes because we couldn't get around the fire on Wednesday night. It was pretty tough to watch. So, yeah, to answer your question, there's a house buried in there, and there's a good chance that that house didn't survive. And we're looking at, I mean, if you know Santa Barbara in the hills, 5,000, 6,000 square foot, multi-million dollar homes burned to the ground. That's a loser. They brought out this isn't it, but they have a DC-10 that actually drops retardant. If you ever get a chance to see that, it's pretty amazing to watch a plane that size put out fire. And it was a very aggressive firefight. They threw everything they had at it. There was no shortage of resources. It just was, all the conditions came together on the right day. And again, this is what we were up against for a couple of days.
Wow.
You can see the winds in those palm trees. Most of this stuff burned late in the afternoon. The fire laid down, and we did mop up most of the day. Hard work, but not real exciting. But once the sundowners kicked in at 3 or 4 in the afternoon, I mean, it was like clockwork every day. This is what we saw. This is late afternoon on Tuesday. And it was pretty amazing to get up in the morning and see every other house burned to the ground. You know, I've been in the fire service 22 years doing this kind of thing, and I've never seen houses just fire bounce from house to house the way it did in May. And May is very early for Santa Barbara to burn. And this is what it looked like when come morning time. Burned very hot, very thoroughly. I included this. This is a Ventura County engine that was overrun on Tuesday night. They took refuge in the house they were trying to protect, and then they had to flee the house when it got too hot. The captain jumped was, I don't know the exact story, but he fled the house to go make sure everyone was safe outside. There was no other crews, and he took refuge in this engine. It got so hot, it melted. If you look at the rear, you can see kind of a hole above the ladder. I'm not sure if that's an SCBA that just exploded through that, but it basically melted the fire engine. And on the other side, the driver's window blew in on him, and he was burned with second and third degree burns and took a lot of window glass into his back. So there were some injuries that same night. This was in our division as well, so we were up there the next morning and working it the next day. There was three other engines crews that had to take refuge in homes and then escape out of the homes and back into their rigs. So some people got hurt on this fire. That's just another view of it from the other side. And this was pretty common. Just scorched earth, occasional house standing for whatever reason. Definitely could see the value of defensible space. If you didn't have defensible space, you lost your house. There was no question about it. If you had adequate defensible space, the fire department could do their best to protect it. But even some with adequate defensible space were lost. It was just that hot. Just some various pictures we found, or we took. And this is the case. Fire season just lasts all year long now. We're in our third year of drought. We're about at 60, 70% of rainfall countywide that we're used to. That's created a lot of down, dead, heavy timber on the ground, which is what made this fire unique. Normally, like I said, this kind of thing doesn't happen till fall around here. To get a fire like this in middle of May was a real wake-up call to California. So you can expect more of this. The problem for us is that we're in the same drought that Santa Barbara is. We have the same heavy ground litter, and they had ladder fuels. We have ladder fuels. Ours is going to be a little different because they're going to get into Monterey Pines and really take off. So we got to be really vigilant, extra vigilant. I'm not here to scare anybody. I know that's, you know, it may sound like that, and I want to make sure that's not the case. It's just that we got to be extra vigilant this year because of the drought and because of the conditions. And we were lucky we got to see this fire in somebody else's backyard on their dime, on their damage, and got a lot of lessons learned from it, and we take back to this district. And then, just so you know, when we go out, we actually make money. We made about, through OES, the fire department will collect between $20,000 and $25,000 for 6 days' work. So we make money, and the district's covered. Anybody have any, with your permission,
sure,
questions?
So just to kind of bring this story home, since most of the houses here in our town are cheek by jowl, very close together, would you expect that with similar meteorological conditions and a fire starting that the fire could spread even more rapidly here?
There's a lot of similarities between us and the Hayseceta incident, and there's some differences that are important. But to answer your question, I think it's going to be way more severe. Monterey Pines don't burn off, and you don't see a lot of Monterey Pine conflagration fires, but it would take a few things coming together, the right winds, the right day, that kind of thing. When it happens and the ladder fuels go, the differences that are going to be really important are this: Santa Barbara is kind of a younger, more mobile, like we said, houses spaced farther apart with access down road so they can evacuate. They basically just go down, sheriff points them in the way, and they go down a foothill road, go right or left. Cambria being home so close together with such heavy fuels, we have a community that's older and not nearly as mobile and narrow, really narrow roads. It'll take one car to block a road going this way and the other car on the other side to block it. And what I predict is more of an Oakland Hills overnight fire, takes an entire subdivision overnight and we're able to get it. But I honestly think one of the big differences you're going to see is we're going to have a lot more civilian fatalities and injuries just because we can't evacuate people the way that Santa Barbara can evacuate. And these guys are old pros. They do it every year. They did it three times last year. They got everything they have packed and they're gone. They know what they're doing. It's really impressive to watch. We just don't have that. So that's a real concern of ours, is how are we going to get an older, less mobile population out of very narrow, winding streets?
That brings to mind emergency evacuation transportation route, if you will, that we had built over the Fiscalini Ranch. Would it be advisable for people who live, let's say, on Marine Terrace in the event of a Lodge Hill fire like this to take refuge on the ranch using that road, or would you recommend something else?
I'd talk to the chief about that and try and develop a more formal plan. But fires are so dynamic. If I was to say go to the, you know, you always go across the ranch, and then we have some event that brings fire across the ranch. Yeah. So I think we need to do some kind of formal plan with thinking of all the possibilities that could happen, or at least some of the more likely possibilities.
I'm going to do something a little out of the ordinary. Given the gravity of this issue, I'm going to ask if there's anybody in the audience who has a question of Captain Gallagher. And if you have a question, step up to the mic so we can all hear you and ask your question, and we'll get some answers.
Board members, Mr. President, Jim Adams, Cambria Water Department, for you who don't know me. I was curious about the water system infrastructure and the support that they had in the fire. Were there shortages? Were they private property wells themselves? Or was there city, municipal water? And if that was an issue.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Normally, we support fire engines doing structure protection or type 3 work with water tenders so that we don't have to rely on the municipal system. The municipal system worked where we were in that division. I can't speak for the whole fire, but in the division we were in, we never had a problem with hydrant water. Because some of these houses were way up, they had their own pumps and wells, and we would go to a house and the wells would be
burned over, and the pumps would be burned over, and they'd be just spewing water for days and days and days. It was really difficult to watch. But, yeah, the pumps were just melted, just totally destroyed. The hydrant system seemed to work fine.
Steve, you have a question? Or Amanda, go ahead.
Is there anything that we can do if there's a property and the person who's the property owner has debris that's dangerous debris that they just won't clear it, in terms of like they've either cleared their property and there's a big pile of, and is there any way for us to remedy that?
Chief, you want to handle that? I think I know the answer, but I'll let you take care of it.
This is the ongoing problem for us, is trying to deal with this. Obviously, you have your private property, and you have your vacant lots. You have the developed lots, and they're all very close together. So it's difficult to get the defensible space without relying on the vacant parcel or the neighbor next to you. The CCSD Fire Department has jurisdiction over vacant parcels. We try to address that annually with the Fire Hazard Fuel Reduction Program, which we're currently kicking off now, and to try to institute, we've got grant funding to try to deal with some of the vacant parcels, the larger vacant parcels that are district-owned, to create what we call shaded fuel breaks or fuel break areas. The enforcement, what is referred to as the LE-100 or the Public Resource Code 4291, which deals with the improved parcels with homes on it, falls under the jurisdiction of CAL FIRE's inspection. They have enforcement authority over that. Currently, we are trying to work hand-in-hand with CAL FIRE to try to address the issues that are in the community and deal with it on a two-pronged approach to where we're covering more ground. That being said, it's a large forest. There's a lot of fuel out there, and we don't have a lot of resources within the fire department and with CAL FIRE to get on it to deal with it. We're doing what we can with the contractors and with those three programs. Obviously, if there's an issue with a debris pile that needs to be addressed, please call us, report it to us, and we'll do what we can to try to get it taken care of. Also, I'm hoping that we might be able to come up with some chipping fund money this year through a grant to be able to address some of the homeowners that have fuel that they would like to clear and drag in that we can have chipped.
I know there was at least one more hand. Steve, yeah, please come up.
Steve Cole, I noticed impressively that there was a water tanker circling overhead fairly early on our Cambria fire, and I was wondering if that's fairly normal, and also if they did drop water on our fire.
Thank you. Captain Gallagher or Chief Miller, either one.
That is part of a wildland response. If any wildland fire during wildland season is called in countywide, part of wildland response is air tankers immediately. Air tankers, dozers, hand crews, a number of engines, they're on it immediately. I wasn't at that fire, but I don't believe, and let me ask the chief.
Chief Miller? Excuse me.
Yes.
Did the tanker drop on that fire?
No, we did not have a tanker drop.
So there's your answer. The tanker did not drop, but it is an initial response, first alarm.
We referred to the air tanker that was circling that everyone saw as our ace in the hole. If things went south, it was there for us, but we didn't require a drop from it.
Chief, what happens in a situation where we're in the what we used to call the fire season, although I understand it's 12 months out of the year now. But what happens in a situation where there's a fire in Malibu, there's a fire in Topanga Canyon, Laguna Beach, Santa Barbara? Oftentimes we have multiple fires up and down the state. What happens to those resources like the aerial tankers?
The tankers are committed and coordinated through the OES. if there's a requirement for an air tanker, say in Malibu or something, and they deplete the resources from Paso, the next available resource for this area would come from the closest available. In the instance of the fire we had on May 14th, the air tanker and the air attack was out of Fresno. So the resources out of Paso were not in town then, which didn't really factor into a large time delay for us of getting them there, because, you know, I guess by air, Fresno is not that far from our area, and those resources arrive fairly quickly. But in the instance later into the fire season where stuff is spread all over the place, there could be a considerable delay in getting those kind of resources. And when the resources are drawn down, they're starting to bring them in from out of state, and they're doing whatever they can, and we're, you know, it can be a bad situation for us.
So it's an ace in the hole, but the ace may have been dealt. Somebody else is playing
yeah,
the hand.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
I think we have one more question. If I see Jerry McKinnon still standing, yes. Jerry?
Thank you. There's an old saying, there's always a 10% that doesn't get the word. The Diablo Canyon plant, should there be a nuclear accident, has sirens posted all around the county to alert people. If we were to have a fire or the beginnings of a fire in Cambria at nighttime when people are sleeping, do we have a system that will wake people and shake them out of their beds, or will we just smell smoke and go on our way? Thank you.
Chief?
That's a good question, Jerry. Basically, what we've looked at here in Cambria is the reverse 911 system. There are some caveats with that, but that is a resource that's available to us through Atascadero State Hospital. We call them, we tell them the coordinates of where we want an evacuation, and they're capable of putting out a reverse 911 phone call to all of the residences in that quad that we specify. And I believe it's to the tune of, I think in 20 minutes they can cover like 500 homes with that. Don't quote me on that specifically, but it's a fair amount, and it's as good as it gets right now. That's been a topic of discussion with our fire focus group locally here, and we're looking for other types of resources to deal with that. Whether horn sirens are a reality here, I don't think that we'll see that, but I think the reverse 911 enhanced system is more of a reality for us.
Chief, board members?
Chief, I assume that doesn't apply if you rely on a cell phone for your communication, because they are not physically connected to your home, so they don't know where you are.
That's a good point. No, I don't believe that it would. It would only be the numbers that are attached to the addresses of the home in a certain area.
Any other questions, board members?
Could we ask that Mike introduce his team? I didn't know.
Yes.
Mike, was that your team here present today that went out on the HCC?
No.
Do you want to stand up and say their names, though,
yeah,
that were with you?
Yeah.
I mean, who was on the fire with you?
For the engineer was Jonathan Gibson. He's been with us a few years. The first firefighter one was Sean Weber, who's actually hiding in the back. And Will Walker, another, grew up in Cambria, was our other firefighter. It was his first opportunity to get out of county, so he learned probably the most of all of us. He got the most benefit out of it.
Terrific.
And so that you understand, a strike team is five engines of the same type. So we took a Type 1 out with four other departments, gave out their Type 1 engines, and our strike team leader was Kevin Taylor from Paso City Fire. And the assistant strike team leader was a gentleman from San Luis City Fire.
Great. Well, Chief Miller and Captain Gallagher, thank you for your presentation today. Thank you for your work on these recent fires. And just in general, thank you for what you do.
Absolutely.
Much appreciated. Thank you very much.
And just one point of clarification. Mike mentioned that we make money. I'm just going to clarify his semantics.
Yeah.
The CCSD does not make money. We basically break even because while those guys are out getting that additional training, we have to cover and backfill their shifts, and that results in overtime mostly and or additional staffing. So we pretty much break even. We don't have to go into our pockets, though.
Yeah. We're not in the business of being mercenaries. Right.
Before we leave the general manager's report, is there anything to report relative to state takeaway, or are we planning for that?
I daily am being in contact or at least reviewing, as well as Al Labasse here, just in case we get the notices. I forwarded one yesterday to you that came from Aqua, although we'll be out of that membership as of July 1st as a result of our budget cuts. But we're just, as soon as I get information or we're aware of it, and we'll share it. I know that we'll be probably in the next meeting that the Finance Ad Hoc Committee and I have. We'll be talking about at least looking forward and what that impact might be.
Well, one of the questions I had on that is that in looking at our budget, the water and wastewater funding.
Director Cliff, let me interrupt you for just a minute. We're having trouble hearing up here, so if we can please, if you have conversations, take them outside the room. That would be very helpful. Go ahead.
The funding on the the funding of the water and wastewater department doesn't involve any property taxes. Was the understanding on this takeaway is from property taxes, not from water and wastewater rates? Or I saw in the LA Times yesterday at beginning to think about going after water and sewer providers, but it kind of implied they had property taxes, whereas we don't seem to have property taxes in our water and wastewater.
Yeah,
you know, you're absolutely right. We don't use property taxes to fund your water and wastewater services. A volatile situation, so they're looking for anything and everything. Al, you said you had something you wanted to add, so feel free.
President, members of the board, it just so happens I got off the phone about 10 after 12 before the meeting with my contact at the county tax collector's office, I'm sorry, assessor's office, and I was asking, you know, the very question that you're asking. They know nothing, so I can't add anything in that regard. She did give me some pointers. Tammy was correct. We do not receive property taxes for our enterprise funds. Some districts do, and it goes back to 1974. What you got in 74 was written into law, continues. And she told me where to confirm that with the state controller's office. Again, I got off the phone and came right here, so I haven't looked into that, but I'm going to confirm, because she said they've run into where the controller's office has some districts recorded wrong, that they receive property taxes, but they don't, but they still take the money from the county, you know, since.
Right.
But so that might come out of our general pot, and then we'd have to correct it. So I'm going to double check on that. But they hear different things every day from Sacramento, and right now they don't know any details.
Okay.
Yeah, I suggest that the Finance Committee will need to meet on perhaps a moment's notice as soon as some more definitive word comes out from Sacramento.
On the ad hoc co-location committee with the healthcare district, we met ways that we can coordinate the resources of both the CCSD and the healthcare district, and so it was really very refreshing, very positive, very forward-looking on their part, and I have to say I'm just as pleased as could be. We are we directed our executive staff to immediately begin to put together the areas where we could coordinate resources, and nothing was off the table. Everything was to be considered, and we're trying to put together another meeting here next week, and that will be discussed, and we're on a very fast track to see what's possible here on this coordination of resources so that it works out better for everybody in the community. And I do have to say that I am just pleased as could be with the response of the health care district and their willingness to look at all kinds of things to see what we can come up with for the community. So that's where we stand on that. We'll be meeting again probably first part of next week and maybe more than once after that before the end of the fiscal year.
Thank you, Director Clift. Any questions? Any other board committee reports? Yes, Director Chaldicott.
Yeah, I guess we should mention that the first meeting of the Water Emergency Committee will be tomorrow at 1 o'clock in room 204.
Mary Webb, Cambria residents, thank you for allowing me to speak. Especially with uncertainty in, as you were just talking about, in state budget and the fact we're in a financial crisis, I just wanted to comment on the fact that our legal fees now have doubled from where they were last year. We are paying Carmel and Associates, expenses for April were $18,519.86. And what I understood from the paper and from the board was that Art Montandon has resigned, but I see now on the website for Carmel and Associates that Montandon is actually a partner in that firm. So I have a question as to whether or not Art Montandon is still being paid, and was there a board decision at some point that said we're going to go ahead and pay Tim Carmel and Art Montandon, so now we have two lawyers instead of one, or how does that work? I'll go ahead and continue. Also on April expenses, there are continuing expenses for Davidson and Associates to the tune of $5,304. And I don't see any reduction in expenses there. Innovated Concepts, it's $5,766 for broadband services. I know many comments have been made that these services could be provided at much less than that, but we don't seem to get any further ahead with that. Is there some way to pay less for internet services than $5,766 a month? Also on April expenditures, Pacific Gas and Electric bill is $20,000, which is about the average that it was last year. And I propose that when or if we ever get to vote on DCEL and have DCEL, these electric rates, or we have any kind of a bulk rate there. And, of course, the budget you talk about a budget crisis on one hand, and on the other, we are paying a lobbyist $6,225 a month to advocate for DCEL. Thank you.
I can address a couple of your questions, and then I'm going to have the general manager respond to the balance. First of all, on legal expenses, you have to understand that if the district is sued, the district, on behalf of the residents of Cambria, has to defend itself. There have been several lawsuits filed. I think most of them are frivolous, quite frankly, but unfortunately, in California, anybody with a couple of $100 and a typewriter can file a lawsuit. So the district is in the position where it has to defend those lawsuits, and that's why the legal costs are going up. With respect to energy costs on DCEL for
why do we have to have two lawyers defend the lawsuits? Don't we just need one lawyer?
Believe me, we are making for a very efficient operation when it comes to the provision of legal services. We don't have two lawyers defending one lawsuit. Hmm. Secondly, when it comes to
energy, we had those lawsuits, though, Mr. Sanders, last year. Why have we doubled the legal fees?
Because lawsuits go through stages, and in the early stages, there's not much to do. As lawsuits develop and they go through the courts, it becomes increasingly expensive because there's more work to do. Secondly, you asked about energy costs on DCEL, and I don't know how many times we've explained that there's a solar energy component to. Now, I'm going to have the general manager speak to the balance of your issues.
Can I just speak to that? Because
no,
I think
we're going to have the general manager respond to the balance of your questions. Thank you.
With regard to the IT costs with Innovative Concepts, you know, these are prior months expenditures, and I've reported before that we are on fiber optics. That's why the cost is much higher for our internet services, and I will not recommend that we go back down to T1 lines. That's what we were on because we were fully absorbed, and we crank out a lot of stuff, and we cannot do that. There's no competitiveness with regard to how we are able to do our jobs every day. Innovative Concepts, as a result of being hooked up to Innovative the fiber optics, we're now able to work with them remotely because they can, so it's just a phone call now rather than an on-site visit. And we're seeing the costs go down. This hopefully will be different next month. With regard to the question about Art Montana then being associated with Carmel and Nakasha, we aren't paying two legal bills. What you saw in this $18,000 is their monthly retainer, which I also explained to you. There's going to be this transitionary period where it might be a little bit higher than the $6,600. And remember, too, there are expenses built. You know, they can charge for expenses. And then the $10,000 was for the litigation expenses. So that $18,000 is representative of their monthly retainer and their litigation expenses. So Art isn't being paid in addition to that. He is right. No longer under contract with the CCSD. And I think the last question was with regard to the you answered the electrical. What was the other one?
Connie Davidson.
Oh, Connie Davidson's under contract, and her services are at a monthly minimum amount, which I believe that amount is under. I don't have her contract in front of me, but I manage her contract, and I'm well aware of the service up for us. But so there's no interruption in service while we wait for the approval of the FY910 budget. I need him to carry through July, so I'll work with you guys on just a time and materials kind of letter agreement for July.
Wasn't he responsible for moving the $2.5 million our way?
Yes, sir.
Yes, he was critical in terms of doing that.
There was some cost-benefit there.
Okay, thank you. We'll now hear from John McKinnon, who has a question on item number 7H.
Thank you, board members. Just an observation. I was just reading this through when I got the package that was here today. Regarding officiating a possible 218, and to go on record, I'm not going against this, you know, round of rate increases, so that's not where I'm coming from, if any problem with that. When you have a 218, you generally have the government on one side and the public on the other. And, you know, I think the public, where they're coming from to get somebody to officiate, is to get somebody that represents them. Carol Cawley, you know, has a great resume and a lot of expertise, but I'm happy that we've got our CCSD as our representative from the government counting those votes and trust them to do that. To put somebody to officiate, I think, should be from the public sector, would be a more logical direction to go, possibly a tax watch association or somebody from that kind of a position would. You know, I just think seems more logical than another person that's had a whole life career in the government. So, all right. Thanks.
Thank you. All right. I have no more requests to speak on consent calendar items. Is there a motion to approve the consent calendar?
D, consider adoption of Resolution 18-2009 nominating Director Merle Clift as a candidate for election to the Special District Risk Management Authority Board of Directors. 7E, consider Resolution 22-2009 approving assignment of banking powers for the Cambria Community Services District's bank and investment accounts. 7F, consider approving extension of intent to serve letter for senior care facility Michael Clark, applicant APN 024.191.052. 7G, consider approving extension of intent to serve letter for Cambria Shores Inn, Kim Eady, applicant, APN 022.381.002. And 7H is to consider ratifying general manager's approval of professional services proposal by Carol Cowley, a CMC, which is a certified municipal clerk, to officiate the 2009 water and sewer rates protest process.
Is there a motion to approve the consent calendar?
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent calendar as published and read. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. We'll now move to hearings and appeals, and we do have a public hearing scheduled today to confirm itemized report of water and wastewater standby or availability charges as provided in Government Code Section 61124. Madam General Manager.
Thank you. Today you have in front of you our staff report, which includes the attached financial report And I think this is what we had from last month. Let me see if there's one other attachment to. And the resolution 21-2009. And staff's recommending approval. This is a report to show you today that we have the itemized report of what those charges will be for water and wastewater standby availability. If anyone had asked for it, and it's available today. And we ask that you, after the public hearing and you take testimony, that it be approved.
Are there any questions of the general manager? Apparently not. I will open the public hearing. We have two requests to speak. The first is from Amanda Rice.
Thank you. Good afternoon, President Sanders, Board. I have two specific questions. The first is, if the standby availability fees are to pay for future capital improvements, why aren't all the properties in the district, including those who will benefit from the improvements in the future, included in this assessment, like people that are on the water wait list? Because it does indicate that the fees will be used for the capital improvement projects, which means that those people on the wait list will have a proportional benefit for their parcel. The second question is related. There's ample justification included in the resolution regarding the exemption from Prop 218. And in the report, there's an emphasis on the need for it for the to fund capital improvement program, at least partially, because the capital improvement program is large. Why is there no mention of using the funds specifically for capital improvement programs or restricting?
Yeah, under Prop 218, the sewer has to be immediately available. It has to actually be in existence and usable.
Right.
That's the restriction, and that's why.
And I apologize. I was looking up the answer to that, and I didn't hear the second question. What was the second question? unless Al heard it, and did you hear the question, Al? Okay, so
yeah.
If you can respond, that'd be great.
The finance officer.
I apologize.
We'll do that.
Under fund accounting, a fund's revenue has to be captured in that fund, especially with enterprise funds. It would be redundant to say that these are going to stay in the water and wastewater enterprise funds. That is, again, basic governmental accounting.
They're required to be kept there. That's where they will be kept
and used.
They'll
of course.
Be accounted for separately and placed in the enterprise funds.
Right. Generally, since I've been here, so much capital work has been done, there's no reason to track it separately. The way I look at it is we use those funds first and then whatever other funds for the capital. If we get to a point where we're not doing enough capital, then that would become a reserve for capital projects.
But they will be restricted in terms of expenditure, and they will be kept in the enterprise funds.
The respective water and wastewater, yes.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Amanda.
If I just may clarify, my question was more to why it wasn't in the resolution. There's a lot in the resolution about the other things that are legal that you're supposed to be doing, like that it's legal according to 218 and all of that, but why isn't it in the resolution that those are the that's where the funds are supposed to be expended?
I think the answer is because the law requires.
Mary Webb, I'd asked a question April 23rd about water, wastewater standby availability fees, mm-hmm. as to whether or not there was a sunset clause on these fees. Are these going to be approved yearly in this way through a resolution, or is it every other year, or do the fees ever go away? Is it this? Are we on for this forever?
We consider this yearly.
Yearly.
That's correct.
Okay. My objection is to fees being used in any way applied to a desalination project, which is a project that Cambrians have never voted on. Thank
Duly
you.
Duly noted. Thank you. Are there any other persons in the audience who would like to address the board on this matter? Apparently not. I will close the public hearing. Board members, what is your pleasure? Director Clift.
I will move adoption of Resolution 21-2009 confirming the itemized report of water and wastewater standby or availability charges.
Is there a second to the motion?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to adopt the resolution, et cetera. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. We'll now move on to regular business, and we have a water conservation presentation. I will turn it over to you, Madam General Manager, to introduce Corey.
Okay, thank you. And Corey's here. Oh, there you are. Okay. Corey Ryan is here to present an update and some reminders about water conservation. And I know that if she needs Jim to tag team with her, Jim Adams, our water system supervisor, is here as well. So go ahead, Corey.
Good afternoon. Thank concerns you. Is having enough water to be able to fight big fires in situations like what we could have been faced with this last month. We've had a couple of things occur that have been big water users for us, and it really kind of drives it home about exactly how little water we have and how we need to take the time to make sure that we're conserving, and while we already as a community conserve quite well, just taking that extra step and not forgetting about what we have to do to prepare for the future. This is a little model of what of drought severity in California area. We clocked in this year, and I think it's pretty safe to say we're right at the end of our rain season. So we've clocked in at about 13.35 inches, which is just above extreme drought. And so that's going to become a big factor for us coming into the summer months. This is an example. We hear a lot of people talk about where does the water go? Who's using all the water? This is just a little breakdown of where our water's where it's going. So the whole pie represents every bit of water that we've produced for the year, and the single family uses 70%, but they're a huge. We have a lot more residential users than we have commercial. Our single family user in 27 accounts. So they do, for that many accounts, they do use a significant amount of water. So just make that clear, because a lot of times we kind of overlook that. And I'm not trying to put down the commercial businesses, because obviously they need to use water to make their businesses successful, and that's what makes Cambria what it is. But just wanted to kind of show that, so that people know that not only the residents need to be responsible for conserving, but the commercial entities need to be aware also. These are four examples of how we can reduce our water usage, and a lot of it we already do. So firstly, don't overwater. I'm just going to go through these really quick, because then I'll touch on them individually. Rethink your landscapes and fix leaks and consider water reuse. As far as not overwatering, if you use water between the hours of 6 p.m. and 9 a.m., you're going to be able to water more efficiently in your landscapes. We have a lot of wind that comes up in the evening time or in the afternoons, and the heat, we don't get a lot of heat, but it is warmer than between the 6 p.m. and 9 a.m. hours. Those heat and wind lead up to evaporation and the water that you're trying to put on your plants going elsewhere. And you can save up to 25 gallons per day if you just 3 inches underneath that top level. Your plants are still getting irrigated, and they're still wet, and they're still being they're still healthy. So kind of take a look at that and make sure that it's not just the surface that's dry, and that your plants actually need some irrigation. If there's water running down the street, you're overwatering, and that's 15 to 25 gallons per each minute. Adjust your sprinklers regularly. Lots of people think, okay, I'm going to put in some drip irrigation or an irrigation system, and I could just put it in and go and not worry about it ever again. Nope, not really. You always have to watch them. You have the lawnmowers mess them up, just foot traffic, any kind of thing that will, you know, your pet pit bull comes and likes to chew on those nozzles or something. But that's a big user, because you walk down the road. You walk down the road and you see, okay, I'm going to give an example. There's a place right down from my parents' house, and they turn on their sprinkler in the middle of their lawn, which is probably no bigger than this area right here, and they're watering their house, and they're watering the sidewalk, they're watering the street. Grass is still brown because the water comes up and out and over, watering everything but the lawn. So that you have to make sure that you adjust those sprinklers. When you water between 6 p.m. and 9 a.m., you end up usually watering at 4 a.m., and nobody watches their irrigation system at 4 a.m. So, but I'm coming to work about that. I'm getting up and seeing everybody's systems go off, and I'm like, oh my gosh, what are you watering? Then and repair leaks and broken sprinkler heads, that's right in that same category. Drip irrigation systems are a much more efficient way of irrigating rather than using sprinklers. Smart controllers, those are actual irrigation controllers that respond and have sensors for what the weather is, or if your soil is moist, if it won't turn the system on until it's dry enough that it requires irrigation. And they just keep getting better and better, and they can save up to 40 gallons per day. And then a big one is replacing lawn areas. There's all kinds of different ways to beautify your surroundings without using lawn. But try convincing your husbands of that, because that seems to be the big issue. Men just, that's the rite of passage. Men have to have a lawn. I've arrived. I have a lawn. Okay, this is an example of inefficient irrigation techniques. We have a couple of things going on here. You can see the runoff on the street, irrigating the street a little bit there. This system doesn't have enough pressure in it, so it's just misting, and then that's the wind's going to take that away from where they're really wanting to irrigate. It's going to evaporate quickly, and they have they're watering a fire hydrant. I don't know if they realize water is in a fire hydrant. They don't need to water it. Oops. Okay, now we'll go on to checking for leaks and knowing your system. This is an example of the radio read meters, and they'll have a transmitter device that you will first arrive at because it sits up higher than your meter, and don't try to take that thing off. You have to go a little bit lower. It sits on a rebar post that's a little bit higher. The meter has a lid on it that you flip up, and then you'll see this. The white dials that have black numbers on them, number one, that is what you will see on your utility bill as your actual read. So if that said 75, that means that you've used 75 units of water. So the next billing period, if you use 80, then, or your read is 80, then your usage for that billing period would have been five units. And five units means that that meter has gone around 7.48 times, because this meter actually reads in cubic feet. But the important part of knowing your meter is, not, you don't have to know all the details. You just know that you're only going to read the black numbers on the white dial. We don't use the black dials with white numbers as far as billing goes. And also that number four, that little blue snowflake-looking thing, if that thing's moving and you don't have water running through your system, or you don't think you should be having water moving through your system, then you need to check some things out, because that is a leak detector. It's on a magnetic suspension, and it's going to turn if there's water going through your meter, and it will detect the slightest bit going through, but then you have to discover stopped spinning. And if it stopped spinning, then you know that your problem is inside your home somewhere. There's something's flowing water in your home. And you know that because you've just shut off the water to it. So if it stops turning, then it's not grabbing that water any longer. If it continues to turn, you could have two problems, or one of two problems. It could be in your main line somewhere, or an irrigation system if it's not routed through your home, or your shutoff valve could be malfunctioning. So you can't eliminate your home completely if you do the shutoff valve test. And then you kind of go from there, and you know what if it's in your house. You have to go and check all of your fixtures, which we'll talk about here in a few minutes. And if it's in your main line, the best way to figure that out is to check your landscaping and see if there's a patch of that beautiful lawn that's bigger and fuller and you just mowed it and it's 3 inches now, then that's a good indicator that that's where, or the rest of it's brown because you've been conserving and you have one patch of green, that means that that's probably a good area that might be suspect of a leak. And then this is a really good website link. Many of you might be familiar with it. It's the H2O house, which basically takes you through a guided tour of a home, and you could click on all of the plumbing fixtures, and it'll tell you how you can check for leaks, how you can depending on how you look at it, to a 1.28 gallon per flush, which is a dual flush toilet, and that's as of the 1st of July. So if you don't have anything that works to that standard, go out and find something. They work great. And especially if you got in on that 1.6 gallon toilets when they were first coming out and they don't work very well, now's a great time to replace them with our $150 rebate. Shower heads here in Cambria, we require that they be a 2.5 gallon per minute with a shutoff valve. Shutoff valves are important because you waste a lot of water while you're trying to wash your hair. Sorry about that. When I say be aware, just be more alert. I know that before I was water conservation coordinator, I probably didn't pay attention to half of the water use around me, and now I'm like, people are like, Corey, breathe. It's okay. You know, it's some other town. You're on vacation. But really, I mean, it's California, and it's really all of our water eventually. And so when you be aware, it's if you're brushing your teeth and you leave the water running, or you're doing your dishes and you leave the water running, come into your home and you hear a toilet running or a leaky faucet, just being aware of that water running sound, maybe not to the extreme of me. I don't recommend that, but just being a little bit, have heightened awareness. The recirculating pumps we do have available. You can come visit me at the fire department, getting hot water quickly to your furthest fixtures. The only other thing that's not really self-explanatory on this is hardscape maintenance. That's a really polite way of saying, please do not hose down your driveway and don't water your house in the street. Use sweeping. Sweeping's the best way. It's good exercise, too. And so that's just, there's other ways to make sure that you clean those surfaces rather than pressure washing them and what have you. On washing your car, you are allowed to wash your car. Just use a nozzle that shuts off so that you won't have all that running. Okay, and then this is considering using water reuse. We have the reclaimed water facility out on Santa Rosa Creek Road. It's treated water. It could be used for landscapes. It could be used for agriculture and car washing. These are the things that you can use it for. as long as you have a way to transport it from there to your location that you need to use it. And when I say fountains, I don't mean drinking fountains. That's decorative fountains. So if you have kids that like to drink out of your decorative fountains or something, I don't recommend that either. And then gray water, you have it's untreated water that we've talked about before, and there's a lot more advances on the regulations and the permitting for such. You have to contact the county to find out what's and that's it. Does anybody have any questions?
Any questions of Corey? Yes, Director McKinnon.
Corey, are you still selling that little RF device, the little receiver that can tell you exactly what's happening and you're wondering?
Yes, very good question. If you don't want to or don't have the means to go and look at your meter, we do have the Orion meter monitors, which are magnetic. You can stick them on your fridge or in your mailbox or somewhere, and they actually read the meters on the same radio frequency that we read the meters when we go and collect the reads for billing, and they'll display the read. Has two different cycles so that you can set it to plan A and it could read through the whole billing period, or you could set it to plan B and say, oh, I'm not sure that my washer is working right, or, you know, the wife wants you to replace the washer and she's saying it's not running efficiently, and you could just test it out and say, okay, let's run a cycle and see. And but yeah, they work out really nicely. They do have an LCD light on them too that will indicate if that snowflake is turning for a 24-hour period, I believe.
So that would indicate a leak.
Right.
But it has to be off for a certain, like, hours during the 24 hours?
Yeah, the leak.
And then it'll be all right?
Yeah, the leak detectors will signify if there has not been at least an hour break in usage in a 24-hour time period.
Do many people have it in camera?
Don't want to overstep and say everybody, and then somebody's going to say, oh, I don't have that. But almost everybody has a leak detector, but we only have maybe, I don't know, 100, maybe 100 monitors.
So very, very limited use.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Corey, if you would stand by, I've got one request to speak from Elizabeth Bettenhausen.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. I'm Elizabeth Bettenhausen, a resident of Cambria. I want to thank Corey for this presentation. It's always helpful to get more education in Cambria on conservation issues. I don't want to get into the gender issue about lawns and males and females at all, but I do want to report that as I left the house to come to this meeting, in our wonderful cactus patch, we have evidence of sedentary but amply fed deer. And I won't elaborate that. My first question, how do you arrive at a definition of extreme drought? If we've had over 13 inches of rain this year, by what criteria do we determine extreme drought? That's my first question. The map of the residential percentage of all the customers, as well as commercial and others, the residential customers in Cambria use an average of 9 units. The overall customer base uses an average of 12 units. And back in 2000, we got a breakdown of how many units were used through the whole customer month, what percentage in the residential, for each lumping of about 5 unit increments. I'd like to see that also for commercial, for vacation rental, and for a multifamily, as well as single unit. So if that could ever be provided, I'd be a happy person. Most of the data was there in 2000, and since 2002, I've been asking. I think there's a real possibility here to help Cambria as a whole. When you have a new resident, as we do across the street frequently on our little block on Park Hill there, they are baffled by all these regulations about conservation. They've never heard of them. Now, they didn't obviously go ahead and check themselves, but I would think if you get a meter and a permit to use it for a residence or for a business, attached to it with a bow tied are all these wonderful things that were presented today. And therefore, it could come directly from the CCSD, and we'll use a backup as well. Every real estate company in Cambria, out of its duty to the planet Earth and the well-being of us all now and in the future of our grandchildren, every real estate agent will hand out the same conservation to information to everybody who's even vaguely interested in living here. And we might throw in a few things about how close you can build your houses together and what to do with the brush in case the neighbor isn't exactly cleaning it up. So maybe the fire department could build into this as well. Thank you.
Thank you for your suggestions, Elizabeth. You did have a question about where the standard comes from for determining the various gradients of drought. Corey, would you like to respond to that?
In SLO that they are, some of the commercial establishments are using waterless urinals. And I'm just wondering if it would be cost-effective to suggest those for our commercial customers.
We're reviewing that under our rebate, our review, for lack of a better word. Yeah, we've been working on reviewing the rebate program, and waterless urinals are in that category.
For next year, you'll note that we only have $2,000 available, $2,000 down from $10,000.
Right.
So we know next month we're going to be bringing to you what that's going to be limited to, and then when that $2,000 is gone, it's gone.
It's going to be first come, first serve.
First come, first serve. So,
that's right.
You know, it's going to be very challenging. And what we have noticed, just, you know, from a very basic observation, not any extensive research, is that we're now starting to get people coming back a second time for toilet replacements, okay, because the program's been there. So Corey's right. You know, we've talked about several things that could be involved, but remember, it's just $2,000. So,
thank you.
And that's a good point, too, is Mrs. Bettenhausen's comments about the owner or the new packets. We did, we're giving out customer information packets when they'd be new water users to Cambria. And there were some current concerns about the cost, so we've no longer been doing that.
Thank you. Jerry?
Jerry McKinnon again. My shoulders are broad and I can take the heat. I have a lawn and I'm not going to tear out my lawn because I have a grass that does not require water. It grows wild here. It makes a beautiful lawn. I wish I could remember the name of it, but it's a grass that was, I believe, well, this will get us in trouble again, brought in from Africa in order to control soil erosion. It's an excellent ground cover. It never turns brown. It has a dormant season, but it's always green. So please take a look at your nursery or at the roads that are dirt roads alongside and see that grass. Take your little shovel along, skim off a section of it, take it home and plant it. Excellent grass. Thank you.
Thanks for the suggestion. Thanks for the suggestion, Jerry.
Well, I tell you my address, but I live on this dirt street, and I park my car on the street, and you'll cover with dust. So if you come by real slow. It's on Emerson Road, 2580 Emerson Road. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who would like to address the board on this issue? Amanda, I thought I saw your hand up. Please.
I just had a question for Corey. You had the breakdown of usage by type, and there was 3% was district use. Does that mean that we only have 3% leakage, or that's the amount that goes out through the – that's the breakdown by the amount that goes out through the meters?
Corey?
Yeah, that's actually meter
metered
usage.
Water.
Yes.
Right. Okay. All right. Thank you. Board members, any other questions?
Can I make one final comment?
Yes,
this is a
please.
Good time since I've noticed with some of the customer issues I've had to deal with in the past month or so. To remind people to turn off their house valve when they're going out of town. I know that since we live here and those of us or an earthquake, or any incident that you may not even think of, or someone who's taking care of your home and they use your toilet and then it runs for the entire week or two that you're gone, it's just a really good idea, and we try to advise as many people as possible. So I'm just taking this opportunity to remind the viewers at home that it's just a great idea.
Thank you. Director Clift.
One other thing, even if you don't turn that off, please turn off the valves to your washer and dryer if you're going to be away for a period of time. I will give you an idea of that. That is the number one claim in the insurance industry right now. The biggest cost in insurance right now to the insurance companies is washers, hoses not being replaced, and they break. And they're no longer in the garage where your neighbor used to come and say, hey, there's water running out the street. They're now upstairs, and there are multiple damages to homes from people who have been gone for a week, and they come back, and that water runs for 2 or 3 days before someone finds the damage. Just if you turn that off, that would be wonderful. Granted, if you turn off the house thing, it's better.
And then help us remind the vacation homeowners and the second homeowners. I mean, extend yourselves, like Corey said, to beware. You know, let's extend ourselves to our neighbors that we know aren't here all the time to just, hey, did you cut your water off before they leave? Because we all have them.
Could I just add one more?
Please.
There was a study in L.A. City, I think, some years ago of the flapper valve, and the average life is 5 years. So if you've had that flapper valve in 5 years, the chances are it's leaking.
Things, when she was referring to sprinklers and the control boxes and everything, I just wanted to add, when you do your smoke detectors, change the batteries in your smoke detectors, it'd be a good idea to change the batteries in your irrigation clocks, because the majority of the residents that have these elaborate irrigation systems, they're automatic, and a lot of us aren't here for periods of time. And the power goes out, as we know, in this community. So those would be good to change out, because once the power bumps and that battery's dead, your systems malfunction, and then we get calls from your neighbors. So that would be a really good idea to put on your calendars with your smoke detectors. And another, the timing of this is great, because we're going into April, and production is up. It's a normal event for our production to go up from March to April. This is just a common event. Rainfall has a lot to do with it. Well, then that goes to outside irrigating. So just keep that in mind when we're going into these dry months, that production does normally go up this time of year. So.
Great. Thank you, Jim.
Yeah.
All right. With that, we will move on to – yes, Director Cliff, did you – have you had it? You did not. Okay. We'll move on to the next item under regular business, which is to receive the fiscal year 2007-2008 management letter from Crosby and Sindrich CPAs and response by management.
So this is an item you asked for,
Madam
us to
General
bring
Manager.
Back,
yes,
and we appreciate your indulgence in waiting on Mr. Bob Crosby as he got through tax season. He's here with us today. You'll see attached to the staff report the comments that he made with regard to recommendations or suggestions to the management, and then
minimal. There are three of them. Do you want to just briefly give us your synopsis of those three issues, and we'll go from there?
Okay. I think we covered two of them last time I was here. The primary one was the district infrastructure, and part of GASB 34 was to identify the infrastructure and all the assets of the district, and then also do periodic reviews as to what maintenance or replacement is necessary to keep the district's infrastructure in good working condition. So that's the first one. Second one is primarily the enterprise fund deficits that were identified in the financial statements, and that was pretty much covered with the rate increase. And then the third item we did not discuss, and that was a relatively minor issue, but it was the fuel in the fuel tanks was not inventoried last year, and there was a problem with that in that it was difficult to do that as far as reading. There's no electronic method of determining what's in the tank, So I don't know if there's a possibility of just using a dipstick or whatever, but we'd like to see the inventory being taken on that. However, it's rather immaterial as far as the financial statements are concerned. Those are the three issues.
Madam General Manager, would you like to respond on behalf of management and inform the board and the public as to how we are going about correcting these deficiencies?
Right, thank you. In our response with regard to the district infrastructure, it's 2004, and we've been talking about the deficits in those funds since then at least. So Bob's right. We have that with the current rate proposal, and hopefully that will be cured. And then the inventory, while Al and I made the response that we believe it's so immaterial, you know, we'll put it on our list of things to do. But it's just one of those things, Bob's right, that doesn't represent a significant problem area, and we'll just have it as something that we might want to consider as a future task.
Let me suggest with respect to the first item, which is the district infrastructure, that the Utilities Committee, Director Chaldicott, take the issue up and in conjunction with the staff develop a program that can be brought back to the board that can get us on the road toward resolving this issue so that our auditor doesn't remind us of it every year and we get it off the list of things to do.
Was that the one where we said that the computer systems could be used to define that? Or?
Well, I think it's probably more comprehensive than that. I think it just has to do with one of the root problems we have here, which is the aging nature of the infrastructure we have in Cambria. And we don't have a systematic program for evaluating the condition of the infrastructure and a program then to replace that infrastructure, which has outlived its useful life. And the object, I'm sure, is to prevent a catastrophic failure where...
Yeah, that's true.
Is that acceptable to the Utilities Committee?
I was just thinking with Brian leaving, that's the memory going out the door. When was replaced.
Well, his phone may be ringing off the hook.
I was going to ask just a question. This is just a control thing. The fuel is used by several different agencies. And do we have an easy method of determining who uses what and if there's a deficiency?
Yeah, and that's totally unrelated to this comment here. That's billed by Al quarterly, I believe. You're doing that right, Al? So the healthcare district, the school district, and am I missing anybody? Is that the only two agencies? Those are billed. Those are tracked, and he has no problems with those. That's not within this comment.
Okay. Mr. Crosby, if you can stand by for just a couple of minutes, we have some requests to speak from members of the audience, and perhaps you can assist in answering their questions if they have any. The first is from Elizabeth Bentenhausen.
I'm not a high-tech person, so when this sits here, I'm a little leery. Put it down. Yes, Elizabeth Bentenhausen, I feel a bit embarrassed by coming up here so often, but then there are people who always say to me down in town, thank you for doing this, so you're welcome, whoever you are. I want to ask another question. I was very glad to hear, Mr. President, that you would like the Ad Hoc Utilities Committee to start addressing what an actual program might look like to pay attention to the that the committee will start taking a more careful look at this. I hope that it will be not only which steel is going to wear through and how soon or what paint is needed, but I hope that you can build into the program that you develop then and you as a board accept a very specific attention to fiscal responsibility and how you define that when you talk about fixing or replacing. This is not meant simply to start rehearsing some of the language we've used for the past 2 years. But, for example, in a question like the structure, the infrastructure of a diesel plant, if we can If we can't come up with a solar system, President Sanders, that uses no electricity from beginning to end, I will stand up and shout that I'm the most dumbfounded person on planet Earth. So I would like some real clarification when you develop your policy and program for looking at materials. What are the criteria by which you're judging the well-being of the infrastructure in all of its distinct parts, as you want to label them? What are the criteria for fiscal responsibility that you're using in deciding when the infrastructure work needs or must be done? And how will you interpret it in detail for us in the community so that we don't have to speculate about any numbers or any definitions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. All good suggestions. The next person to speak is Mary Webb.
Mary will periodically reassess the district's infrastructure and to adequately project and compute the district's needs for future repairs and replacements. I was just kind of shocked. I mean, I thought since we've had the general manager here since 2004, we've been practicing best management practices. And so, again, I agree with Elizabeth that when she says we will take the recommendation for these assessments under advisement, that's not good enough. I mean, it's you know, you have all these future plans for what we're going to do in our community, but we have infrastructure right now that's aging that needs to absolutely be taken care of. It is an emergency if the infrastructure we have now totally breaks down. We don't have anything else right now to replace it. So I agree totally with what Elizabeth has said, and I think she's actually asked most of the questions that I had on this report. Thank you.
Thank you. The next request to speak is from Amanda Rice.
Thank you once again for the opportunity to speak. I would like to again thank the district for having the auditor's report available on the website. And in reading through the auditor report, which is not the letter that this is, but it's related to the auditor's report, so I hope this is an appropriate time to ask. I was looking through it, and there's an item called the Warren Agreement Pipeline, and I was just wondering if somebody could help me clear up what that is. And that may have to be answered at another time.
Madam General Manager?
Thank you.
It's our settlement agreement with Clyde Warren with her. Right. And the, you know, access and water provisions.
Was built from a well in our well field to his property. So that would be the Warren Pipeline. I have no more requests to speak on this item, and I think the Utilities Committee has its marching orders. So we expect that a program for addressing the infrastructure issue raised by the auditor will be coming back to the board at some time in the future. And thank you very much for coming today. We appreciate your presentation.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.
You bet. Thank you. With that, we are at the point in the agenda where we have the second public comment period. I do have one request to speak for this comment period, and that is a public comment period, and that's from Elizabeth Bentenhausen.
I would have said it earlier as my Elizabeth Bettenhausen self, according to the rules, but I did not know that this was Brian Bode's last meeting. I must say, stunned because every meeting I've ever come to of the CCSD since I moved here, there has been Brian Bode as diligent, attentive person as I know on government staff anywhere. I have the highest respect for this man because he always worked to explain projects. He gave us tours. If there were changes that were to be made, he would explain from his perspective what they were all about. He and the staff worked diligently to keep costs down by doing much of the work themselves and not shipping it out somewhere. So I just want to thank in public Brian Bode for being a model of an excellent public official who is going to, I suspect, enjoy his grandchildren even more than he does today. So with that, all that time, Brian, farewell.
Thank you, Elizabeth. That's really, really very kind of you to say that. And believe me, everybody in this town is going to miss Brian. He's been requested to speak from Amanda Rice.
Thank you once again. I feel very middle of the tension. I just want to take a moment there. I foster dogs through Heart, and right now we have a dog that was found on Moonstone Beach Drive about 2.5 weeks ago that has not been claimed. There are signs around town, including one on the outside of this building with a picture of the dog, and we are looking for a home for him in the event that we don't hear from the possible owner. He's about five or six months old. There's pictures of him up on aboutcambria.com, and you can get more information through Hart, who has taken care of getting him his shots and his and getting him fixed and making sure he's healthy. He's a sweet little Jack Russell Chihuahua mix. He's probably about 8 pounds, and he is smart and energetic. So if you want a dog that'll go and run with you, he's absolutely perfect. We're calling him Billy, but you can name him whatever you want. Again, you can call Heart, and their number is 927-RESQ, which I think is 7377. And you can, if you would like to see a picture, there's a picture of him on aboutcambria.com. Thank you for the time.
Thank you. I have no more requests to speak under public comment, so we are adjourned to closed session.